You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area's talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
January 22nd will mark the 51st anniversary of Roe v. Wade, where the Supreme Court issued a 7-2 decision in favor of Jane Roe in 1973, saying that women in the United States had a fundamental right to choose whether to have abortions without excessive government restriction. But all that changed in 2022. When Roe v. Wade was overturned, and it was declared that the constitutional right to abortion, upheld for nearly half a century, no longer exists.
They chose to endanger the lives of all women and all birthing people in this country. But not only that, they've chosen to strip rights from men too. Because frankly, the right to our own bodies and the right to form our families, this is something that belongs to all of us. And it does not belong to lawmakers.
How can I not rejoice that the most defenseless are going to be protected?
This is a step backwards. It means that we have to mobilize. We have to sound the alarm.
I know that they have the my body, my choice, but for me, the baby also has a fundamental right. And I know that to some people that feels like then you're sort of stripping away the rights of the mother. I believe we really as a nation need to come together behind women and provide resources. 75% of abortions are for women who are within 2% of the federal poverty level. So that really is saying like these are women who maybe aren't necessarily feeling like they want to have an abortion, but they're sort of backed into a corner and feel like they're having to choose between paying their rent and having a child. So if we can, as a pro-life movement and as a nation and at each, really get behind women, we have to get behind women.
The Supreme Court of the United States expressly took away a constitutional right from the American people that it had already recognized. They didn't limit it. They simply took it away. That's never been done to a right so important to so many Americans. But they did it. Now, with Roe gone, let's be very clear. The health and life of women in this nation are now at risk.
Now, the conversation about reproductive rights is being had on all levels, federally, in every state, and on the political stage as well. Welcome to KCBS In-Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. 2024 could be a determining year for where the abortion and anti-abortion movements will go next. And so to help us take a closer look at those possible paths, both legally and politically, we turn to Mary Ziegler, Martin Luther King Law Professor at UC Davis and author of several books on the social movement struggles around reproduction, autonomy, and the law. Thank you so much for joining me for this in-depth conversation. Mary Ziegler, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Monday, January 22nd, will mark the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, a landmark decision that secured the right to safe and legal abortions, and that held steady until 2022 when it was overturned. So from your vantage point, what are the conversations focused on right now when we are talking about abortion and reproductive rights?
Well, I think there are probably two parallel conversations, one concerning what's been going on in the states. I think both with respect to a growing number of state bans and fights in state courts about whether those bans violate state constitutions. And then conversely, action at the federal level, which has been taking place both in federal court and increasingly whether questions concerning what 2024's presidential election is going to mean for reproductive rights.
Yeah, that's you laid it all out for me very well, because that's exactly the elements of this conversation that I want to get into. So let's start with the federal level. What efforts are being made on that side of things to reestablish these rights, these reproductive rights? And, you know, where are the hurdles and roadblocks where that's concerned on a federal side?
Well, I think at the federal level, really what we're talking about going into 2024 is not a probability that there'll be new protections introduced for reproductive rights. We're really more looking at the possibility, if a Republican is elected, of new restrictions being imposed on the national level, either through court decision or through executive action. We haven't seen, I think, much prospect of federal legislation passing to protect reproductive rights. Obviously, that could change, but the 2024 election isn't really shaping up at the moment in a way that would make that look likely. There's, of course, some steps that could be taken through executive action, but I think it's worth emphasizing that, you know, the status quo we have now in terms of what's available in states and at the federal level can't be taken for granted, right? That what exists now could be eroded too.
Well, and you know, on that, with the federal side of things, of course, being so tied to how politics are playing out, you know, I kind of have to bring it up that recently former President Donald Trump said that he was proud of his role in overturning Roe versus Wade, but he did also urge Republicans to take a cautious approach when it comes to this issue. You know, what do you think he's meaning by that? And what is he trying to impart to Republican voters here in 2024? Because obviously the primaries are just getting started.
Well, I think former President Trump understands that abortion is not a winning issue right now for Republican candidates. And I think he's advising his fellow Republicans essentially not to talk about abortion. And there are two reasons for doing that. One, obviously, the Republican position on abortion is unpopular, but also too, I think Republicans don't want to be put on record as saying they're not going to do anything about abortion in office. And the incentives for Trump, of course, would change if he were elected, because then he would not be in a position where he could seek re-election, and the incentives may line up for him very differently to try to please anti-abortion donors or voters who were among those who fought the hardest to try to keep him in office following the 2020 election than he does now, when he actually needs to win the 2024 election. So I think what Trump's comments tell us is that, one, Republicans are struggling to find a message, but also, two, there may be a disconnect between what Republicans say on the campaign trail in 2024 and what they actually do once in office.
Well, does the same hold true in any respect for the Democrats when it comes to the, you know, I feel like they would just have to hold steady to their message of supporting abortion rights. But, you know, I don't know if that's equals a shoe-in for them as far as getting votes.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think Democrats are probably going to overpromise and underdeliver, in the sense that they're going to say they're going to be able to actually codify reproductive rights at the federal level when they probably won't. I think for Democrats, the real challenge is not that their positions on abortion are unpopular. That doesn't seem to be true now. It's rather that voters may not be motivated to pick Democratic candidates based on the abortion issue, either because they're not convinced Democrats can do anything, or because they don't understand what a Republican president could do, even if Congress is unwilling to act. I think that's a really fundamental point that most people don't understand. And because, Democrats have to translate support for reproductive rights and ballot initiatives and other measures into support for Democratic candidates. And they've had some success in doing that, but it's unclear how much that's going to happen in 2024.
It'll definitely be interesting to see how this plays out on both sides. I do think a lot of our more pointed conversations are happening, though, on the state level. A lot of what we are seeing now is how states are handling reproductive rights and the abortion conversation. And there's, you know, legal ramifications there that we've seen play out. We saw the story with Kate Cox. There's even, another case in Texas where the state is going up against, I believe, 20 people who were denied abortion care, along with, I think, two OBGYNs are a part of that. There's a lot going on the state level. What are you seeing as these cases play out? And I mean, what side do these cases end up falling on, do you think?
Well, we've seen, I think, a strategy emerging to kind of chip away at Dobbs, the decision overruling Roe, by focusing on state law and in particular state abortion exceptions, and essentially arguing that those exceptions are incoherent or that they're being interpreted in a way that's unnecessarily narrow or that they're just unconstitutional under state law. And this is kind of a way of thinking about this is it's kind of an incremental attack on Dobbs. Obviously, this is not supporters of abortion rights asking for federal protections for abortion rights. It's not them saying there's a federal right to abortion. It's much more modest than that, but I think it's designed to educate voters and other people about what the reality of life post-Dobbs looks like and how exceptions that on paper may sound reasonable enough are not working in practice.
There's one case or one situation going on right now in Missouri where they are reproductive rights activists are wanting to get a ballot measure before voters in the fall because that state has one of the strictest abortion bans in the country. But, you know, within the reproductive rights community, there is a sort of a divide going on when it comes to the conversation about viability and what that means. Is this something that we're seeing also play out in other states or becoming a bigger part of how people are deciding what abortion rights or anti-abortion bans are like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's mostly a strategy debate among supporters of reproductive rights that's emerged post-Dobbs. It's not happening everywhere. So, for example, in both Ohio and California, when it came to two very different states, when it came time to get a ballot initiative before voters, people kind of across the spectrum in the reproductive rights community were able to rally around a single ballot initiative. And that, of course, involved, you know, compromise and overcoming strategic differences. But we've also seen those strategic differences come out into the open in Missouri. The differences really are about, I think, two questions. One is sort of a pragmatic question. If you're in a more conservative state like Missouri, is it possible, the question goes, to get voters to support something like a really broad reproductive rights or reproductive justice initiative or not? And if not, is it better to ask voters to do something more modest to essentially, you know, get what you can get, even if it's imperfect? Or not. There's also, I think, a question about, whether that's strategically sound and whether it's principled. So from the standpoint of whether it's principled, you'll see people on one side of the question saying these measures that focus on viability really are damaging to people like Kate Cox and others who need access to abortion later in pregnancy, who are both can be denied access to care under these laws and stigmatized under these laws. And then you also have, I think, pragmatic questions about where voters actually are on issues like viability. So some people will argue that it's quite possible to pass a law without a viability limit and that viability limits are unnecessary, and others arguing they're an important concession.
In Depth will return after a moment. Well, and I think you make a very good point there of what side of this decision-making people are going to fall on. you know, is it going to be an issue that you come at from your own sense of moral judgment? Or is it going to be something where you are being pragmatic? You know, what have you seen coming out of 2023 and coming into the new year? You know, is there a way for there to be some sort of common ground found among voters when it comes to abortion and reproductive rights?
I mean, I think that there probably is some way. I mean, one of the things that you see emerging post-Dobbs is interesting polling suggesting some Americans think fetal life has value and oppose criminalizing abortion at one and the same time, right? So people saying, why can't we be doing more for pregnant people and women instead of throwing bail and causing reproductive rights, right? Essentially, why is it a zero-sum choice between helping pregnant people or even expressing that we think life in the womb has some value and taking away people's autonomy, right? Or putting people in prison? It seems sort of like a lot of Americans in their own personal lives see these things as more complicated than certainly the anti-abortion movement seems to think they are or says they are at times, right? But I think the problem is that the way our politics have shaped up is that especially the Republican Party has been, you know, mostly beholden to people who feel very strongly about this, who believe very strongly in the personhood of the fetus and the criminalization of abortion, which makes the achievement of any kind of like consensus politics in the near term kind of unthinkable. I mean, I think that there seem to be post-Dobbs fairly clear positions that a lot of people in the American electorate have identified about how they feel about abortion, but there's a disconnect between those positions and where our laws are going in large parts of the country.
Well, you mentioned, anti-abortion activists or supporters, wanting to basically say that a fetus is a rights-holding person legally. Has that always been a part of the goal of the anti-abortion movement? Because, you know, I think so much focus has been on Roe versus Wade and getting that overturned. And of course, now that's happened. What's next for the anti-abortion movement?
Yeah, so the idea that a fetus is a rights-holding person was the objective of the movement going back to the 1960s. And it's really been the objective ever since. One way kind of to check this, if people are interested, is to look at the Republican Party platform going all the way back to the early 1980s. You would see calls for a so-called human life amendment that would recognize the personhood of the fetus. The goal, in other words, was never just the end of Roe. It was always the recognition of a fetus as a rights-holding person. So I think the next kind of long game for the anti-abortion movement is the achievement of fetal personhood. It is a long game, of course, because fetal personhood at the moment, at least as anti-abortion groups define it, would be deeply unpopular and doesn't seem likely to be achieved in any way, right, through Congress, probably even through the Supreme Court in the short term. So what you're going to see in the short term is anti-abortion groups pulling the levers they think are going to be the most effective, which are going to involve either the federal courts, which are quite conservative, or if a Republican wins in 2024, the executive branch. So some examples of what that could look like. Obviously, there are two cases before the U.S. Supreme Court now, one of which is designed to cut off access to mifepristone, which is a pill used in more than half the abortions in the United States. That's just one example of anti-abortion groups saying, well, we can win in the courts, even if we can't win with voters. We've also seen the Heritage Foundation work with a coalition of dozens of other conservative groups to create a playbook for a Republican president that lays out strategies of, say, a second Trump administration could use to curtail access to abortion and contraception in states like California without Congress. So, for example, reviving this law from the Victorian era that's never been repealed, that makes it, argue abortion opponents, a federal crime to mail any item used in abortion, which they argue can be used to prosecute abortion providers and drug companies, even potentially people receiving pills in the mail in states like California. So the anti-abortion movement has a playbook for personhood in the long term, and in the near term is trying to use the areas where it can exercise power, essentially to override the fact that voters don't like what the movement's proposing.
Well, on the flip side of that, then, since Roe versus Wade has been overturned, and of course, we've touched on, you know, what the conversations are right now when it comes to abortion and reproductive rights for the side that are in support of that, pro-choice. You know, what's their moves now on the side that supports abortion?
Well, I think the abortion rights side has been doing well with voters since Roe was overturned. So I think what you're seeing essentially is the abortion rights side looking for more and more ways to bypass both state legislators and judges to take this question directly to voters. So ballot initiatives in states all over America, including consequential regional places like Florida. You're also seeing, I think, ongoing fights in the courts, including state courts, where abortion right groups are arguing that bans violate state constitutions. You're seeing abortion rights groups looking to make abortion into a major election issue. And I think you're starting to see abortion rights groups doing a lot of public education too, and essentially saying in the abstract, an abortion ban that has certain exceptions may not sound that harsh to certain voters, but when you understand what it means for real people, it's a completely different story. Or, you know, you may think that if Donald Trump were elected, that he couldn't really do anything about abortion, but it turns out that's not true. So I think the abortion rights side is also doing a lot just to educate voters about what's going on, which is a, you know, it's a tougher job post-Roe, right? Because the fight is no longer just, is Roe going to stay or go? It's much more intricate than it was, you know, a decade ago.
That's definitely true. You know, at the start of this conversation, I mentioned the anniversary that is coming up. And while, depending on what side you are on, Monday can have a very interesting effect, I would think, on people's mindsets and where they're at when we are talking about abortion and reproductive rights. So, you know, let's take a moment here to kind of look back. You know, it took a long time for this decision for legal abortion to happen here in the United States. What did it take to get there in the first place?
Yeah, so, I mean, Roe was obviously the end point of a pretty long struggle. So efforts to reform criminal abortion laws began as early as the 1960s. Often starting with doctors who were frustrated that they couldn't provide the kind of care to their patients that they needed. And they and lawyers began mobilizing to make at first modest changes to criminal abortion laws. And then increasingly, once those modest changes were made, people began to realize that the laws were still not making it possible for patients to access abortion because once there was a criminal prohibition in place, physicians just weren't willing to use exceptions, even if they were on the books. So then feminists and a range of other actors began demanding the outright repeal of criminal abortion laws, and they had support from public health advocates and others. And this battle unfolded in state legislatures, in ballot initiatives, in state courts, and in federal court. So Roe was really the product of, you know, decades long mobilization. It was not just a single Supreme Court. And if you think about who or what gave us abortion rights in 1973, it was really all of those things, right? It was the product of this much bigger constitutional shift, not just something that the Supreme Court decided, you know, one fine day in January 1973. So I think the lesson about that is, you know, that often when constitutional change happens in either direction, right? I think this is true of the demise of Roe as well. There's always a much bigger story that shapes what's going on inside of the Supreme Court. I think that's true post-Roe, between Roe and Dobbs, of changes to the way our democracy works, changes to the way the Supreme Court behaves that made Dobbs possible. So I think as people kind of contemplate what it would mean to get back to Roe, they have to be aware of the fact that certainly, yes, changing the composition of the Supreme Court is important, but it's going to require bigger picture thinking and more grassroots mobilization than that.
Do you foresee more grassroots, as you put it, more grassroots efforts to get back to that point? Or
how do you, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think that over time, in the long term, generally, in a kind of big picture way, the Supreme Court doesn't tend to be out of step with voters for that long. And so generally, the fact that the court is so far from voters on abortion doesn't seem likely to be sustainable in the long term. The caveat, of course, is that that's only true if there's some measurement or some way for you know, the court to be accountable, and also for if the democracy itself is healthy. So if the US's democracy erodes more, then all bets are off. But if things work the way they have historically, the court eventually tends to come into line with popular opinion, and popular opinion is much more in favor of reproductive rights than the Dobbs decision is at the moment.
I think 2024 is definitely going to be a year to watch all across the board, state and national, when it comes to politics and it comes to this issue. Mary Ziegler, Martin Luther King Law Professor at UC Davis, I want to thank you so much for being a part of this conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You can find this episode and past episodes of In Depth online at kcbsradio.com. You can also hear the episodes on the Odyssey app. Download the app on your smartphone and favorite KCBS Radio. For listening for KCBS and In Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
You've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.